Light Brigade Saturday mornings from 6 to noon on WRCT Pittsburgh. And check out Monochrome sessions, from weekly improvised DJ sets to live performances on drum machines and synths. Monochrome Sessions delivers a dynamic exploration of electronic sound, a journey where every moment is as bold and timeless as black and white. Tune in every Wednesday at 11 p.m. where Blackwell brings you Monochrome Sessions live on WRCT. And stick around, we got a lot of really far out music, so if you're into the avant-garde, this is going to be a good night for you. Thanks for tuning in. This is An Experimental Time at WRCT Pittsburgh.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
If there's one place you can count on being open 24 hours, it's 911.
Austin 911, do you need police, fire, EMS, or mental health services?
A small team of people answers the phones for that last option, mental health, trying to help people on what might be their worst day.
I can hear that you're going through some very real and difficult things and that you're very unsafe right now.
We spend a whole day with them in the latest episode of 24 Hours in Austin. Find it at KUT.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
The University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
The late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would have been 96 this year had he lived out a dream for racial equality in this country. He was a man who walked among the oppressed and poor, a man who questioned unfair laws and went to jail rather than submit to them. King was a passionate fighter for civil rights, and although he died by violence, his life and teachings were dedicated to a deep disrespect for violence and its consequences. He won a Nobel Prize for Peace. His lectures and dialogues stirred the conscience of a nation. In November 1983, legislation was signed, creating Martin Luther King Jr. Day, making it only the third national holiday born in the 20th century. In fall 1991, the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, where he was assassinated, was dedicated to his remembrance. On October 16, 2011, the MLK Memorial was dedicated on the National Mall. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., In Black America. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is considered by many as the father of the civil rights movement. Born on Tuesday, January 15, 1929, at the family home in Atlanta, Georgia. He was christened Michael Luther King, but in 1934, Daddy King changed his name after young Martin experienced racial prejudice. In 1944, at the age of 15, he graduated high school and entered Morehouse College in Atlanta with intention on becoming a medical doctor, but changed his mind in his junior year. In April 1948, King received his bachelor's degree in sociology and entered Crozier Theological Seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania. In May 1951, he graduated with a bachelor's of divinity degree and as valedictorian and student body president. In 1955, he earned his doctorate in systematic theology from Boston University. In spring 1963, King nonviolent tactics were put to their most severe test in Birmingham, Alabama, during a mass protest for fair hiring practices and the desegregation of department stores. Police brutality used against the marchers dramatized the plight of African Americans to the nation at large with enormous impact. Established in 1968 by Mrs. Coretta Scott King, the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change has been a global destination, resource center, and community institution for over a quarter century. Nearly a million people each year make their way to the National Historic Site to learn, be inspired, and pay their respect to Dr. King's legacy. On January 20, 1986, the night before the first national celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, Ms. King spoke about her husband and the King Center.
The dreams on which the center is based are bigger than any one of us, yet an integral part of all of us. And so, like all meaningful dreams, the center will endure. The center will always respond to realities, basing its programs on the needs, aspirations, and the aspirations of humankind. It will always stand ready in the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr. to work through programs that, in a clear, comprehensive, and challenging way, use principles of nonviolence in changing lives and social, economic, and political systems. The center is dynamic and in motion, and like this year's theme, is actively helping those who wish to live the dream and saying to all of us that we must not just talk about the dream, we must every day engage ourselves in living the dream. And I say to you tonight that we are challenged at the center to dream like Martin Luther King Jr., impossible dreams, and like Martin Luther King Jr., work untiringly for the fulfillment of those dreams. I can tell you the story of the center has been an impossible dream, and I'm sure Mrs. Ferris can attest to that fact. And as someone said today in our board meeting, I believe it was our chairman, he said, somehow, we don't know how, but somehow, maybe it was Lloyd Davis, our executive director of the Holiday Commission, and Mr. Hill, but there's been something very special about this holiday experience. And there have been so many things that have come together, despite the fact that we've not had the funds, the resources to mobilize a nation as large and as diverse as our nation is. But somehow people got the message, and they went on and organized themselves. It was a great example, Mayor Young, of grassroots organizing. I think I'm qualified to know because I have experienced it during the 30 years of involvement in the civil rights movement. And I can believe, and I hope you share this feeling with me, that it's not going to stop now. The bullet in Memphis could not stop Martin Luther King's spirit. Because what he stood for was based on love, an enduring force, and truth that will always prevail in the long course of history. And I want to say to you, you tonight, let us continue to walk together, to struggle together, to pray together, to keep on living the dream together. Yes, we can achieve the beloved community of which Martin dreamed and which was the essence of that vision he shared with this nation. The dream is in our hands. What will we do with it? Here in the King Center, we will keep on living it. We will keep on working. We will keep on and keep on and keeping on until America, our nation, the great nation that we love, will be transformed truly into that oasis of justice and freedom and equality for all of God's children. Thank you. God bless you.
In 1957 in New Orleans, seeking to build upon the success of the Montgomery bus boycott, and with the hope of upgrading the status of Southern blacks and America's poor, King summoned together a number of black leaders to lay the foundation for the organization now known as the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. King was elected as first president, and he soon began helping other communities organize their own protests against discrimination. The Honorable Andrew Young, former mayor of Atlanta and U.S. ambassador, was one of King's most trusted advisors.
Looking back on it, we think of those as the best days of our lives. Actually, at the time, it was, we really didn't know what we were doing. We knew things were wrong and that somebody had to do something about it. And we just stumbled along from one thing to the other till we found a way to make it work. And fortunately, most of us had read a lot about India, and we understood some of the nonviolent methods of Gandhi. And we just experimented until we found out how to organize people. Nobody was trained as an organizer. We knew the black community. We knew the cities that we were working in fairly well. And we learned gradually, over a period of time, how to get things done.
What type of impact did the late Dr. Martin Luther King have on you at that time?
Well, Martin was an amazing young man. He had been sort of thrust in the leadership. He never really wanted it, and yet he couldn't get away from it. And he was essentially trying to do something for other people. That kind of dedication and the sort of things that he said matter-of-factly, if a person hadn't found something that they're willing to die for, they're probably not fit to live anyway. You know, somebody dropped that on you in a joking kind of friendly conversation. It makes you think, you know, what is it that I'm willing to die for? And you begin to think about your life and think about other people in a new way. I mean, he was amazing that all of the things that he did, and he never lived to be 40 years old. And yet in the midst of it all, he was still privately a very easygoing, a friendly, joking, clowning, you know, lovable guy.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support comes from Austin Energy, offering the EV Buyer's Guide to help customers explore options for electric vehicles. Details on rebates, incentives, and locally available new and used EVs at ev.austinenergy.com.
And now back to this episode of In Black America. In 1953, King completed his doctorate and was granted the degree 2 years later upon completion of his dissertation. Married at the time, he returned to the South to become pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. There, he made his first mark on the civil rights movement. King's plight for justice and equal rights began on December 5, 1955. 5 days after the late Rosa Parks refused to obey the city rules mandating segregation on buses. In 1956, as the boycott continued, King gained national prominence as a result of his exceptional speaking skills and personal courage. Although increasingly portrayed as a preeminent black spokesperson, King did not mobilize mass protest activities during the first 5 years after the Montgomery bus boycott had ended. On August 28, 1963, King led a massive march on Washington, D.C., and delivered one of his most passionate addresses of his career.
Even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is a faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
In 1963, Time magazine named him its Person of the Year. A few months later, in December 1964, he was the recipient of the Nobel Prize for Peace. After his return from Norway, King took on new challenges. In Selma, Alabama, he led a voter registration campaign that ended in the Selma to Montgomery Freedom March. King brought his crusade to Chicago, where he started programs to rehabilitate the slums and provide housing. In April 1968, King lent his support to the Memphis sanitation workers. He wanted to discourage violence and wanted to focus national attention on the plight of the poor and unorganized workers of the city. The men were bargaining for basic union representation and long overdue raises. The strike became the new testing ground for the new direction of the Poor People's Campaign was taking, which merged civil rights issues with economic concerns. On the eve of his assassination, this was King and SCLC's second attempt at a nonviolent protest march.
I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot in the head and is now in critical condition in a Memphis, Tennessee hospital. The latest reports from Memphis say Dr. King was hit by gunfire while standing on the balcony of his hotel room just before 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
The bullet exploded in his face. He was standing at an acute angle, and the bullet knocked him up off of his feet in that direction against that ledge over there. You couldn't tell it was a shot until it hit his face. It sounded like a stick of dynamite or a large firecracker.
Police say a man wearing a dark suit dropped the weapon about a block from the shooting scene and jumped into a late model white car.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? At 7:10 this evening, Martin Luther King was shot in Tennessee. Martin Luther King, 20 minutes ago, died.
For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man.
But we commit his body to the ground. The grave is too narrow for his soul, but we commit his body to the ground. No coffin, no crypt, nor vault, no stone can hold his greatness, but we commit his body to the ground.
On Sunday, October 16, 2011, some 10,000 spectators and dignitaries gathered on the National Mall for the dedication of the memorial for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Among the speakers were a who's who of civil rights leaders, King's children, as well as President Obama. President Obama urged the nation that day to celebrate the dedication of the memorial by continuing to press for the goals and hopes of the black preacher with no official rank or title, who somehow gave voice to our deepest dreams and helped make the nation more perfect.
An earthquake and a hurricane may have delayed this day, but this is a day that would not be denied. For this day, we celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s return to the National Mall. His life, his story tells us that change can come if you don't give up. He would not give up no matter how long it took, because in the smallest hamlets and the darkest slums, he had witnessed the highest reaches of the human spirit. Because in those moments when the struggle seemed most hopeless, he had seen men and women and children conquer their fear. Because he had seen hills and mountains made low, and rough places made plain, and the crooked places made straight, and God make a way out of no way. That is why we honor this man, because he had faith in us. And that is why he belongs on this mall, because he saw what we might become. That is why Dr. King was so quintessentially American, because for all the hardships we've endured, for all our sometimes tragic history, ours is a story of optimism and achievement and constant striving that is unique upon this earth. And that is why the rest of the world still looks to us to lead. This is a country where ordinary people find in their hearts the courage to do extraordinary things. The courage to stand up in the face of the fiercest resistance and despair and say, this is wrong and this is right. We will not settle for what the cynics tell us we have to accept. And we will reach again and again, no matter the odds, for what we know is possible. That is the conviction we must carry now in our hearts. As tough as times may be, I know we will overcome. I know there are better days ahead. I know this because of the man towering over us. I know this because all he and his generation endured. We are here today in a country that dedicated a monument to that legacy. And so with our eyes on the horizon and our faith squarely placed in one another, let us keep striving. Let us keep struggling. Let us keep climbing toward that promised land of a nation and a world that is more fair and more just and more equal for every single child of God. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
In September 1991, the National Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Motel was dedicated. The museum traces the history of the civil rights movement from its beginning to the present. The museum has been built around the hotel where King stayed while in Memphis. His room and that of his aides have been kept as it was that fateful evening in April 1968.
Dr. King had been in Memphis prior to the assassination and prior to the coming in March for the march that broke out in violence. He'd come here before, and he'd stayed at the Lorraine, and this was the room that he'd usually stay in. It's a nice room, a nice king-size bed. Even for that time, you know, that would have been nice. So he stayed here, and we have kept the original furniture that was in the room at the time, and it's been redone to look as it did in 1968. But this is where he was the night of the assassination. That's room 307. Now, of course, here is room 306. And this is the room that was being occupied by some of Dr. King's aides with the two beds in here. But this is the room that he walked out of just prior to being shot. He had been in here with Reverend Abernathy and some others, and they were, as you can see, having some food. There's some catfish on the plate over there, and dishes and glasses and milk and the like. And this room has been recreated to appear as it did on the evening of the assassination. And again, the furniture in the room is all the furniture that was here at the time. One other thing that I like about this room, as the visitor stands in here and reflects and reads these display lines, you also hear, and they light up, you know, when it acts up, you also hear Mahalia Jackson softly singing Precious Lord. And that was Dr. King's favorite song. So it's just, it brings tears to your eyes when it all is operating. You know, I was just so struck by that last little line there. That just, with them putting the casket on the plane there, that just tells it all. Somebody said, and it's just some ordinary person, I said, we really lost somebody, didn't we?
Let me stand I am tired.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was 39 at the time of his death. He was shot while standing on the balcony of the Moraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. This has been a tribute to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who would have been 96 this week. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
President Biden, in his final hours, his final morning in office, has issued several high-profile pardons.
Among those pardoned this morning, Dr. Anthony Fauci, General Mark Milley, and the members and staff who served on the House committee that investigated the January 6th attack on the Capitol, including Liz Cheney.
And police officers who have spoken out as well from the Capitol Police. Let's go right to Chief White House correspondent Peter Alexander. This just broke 10 minutes ago. Peter, what do you know?
Savannah, as NBC News first reported, President Biden, even yesterday, I'm told, was very seriously considering using this extraordinary presidential power to preemptively pardon some individuals. And this morning, as we are reporting, it is clear that he has decided to do just that in these final hours in office to guard against any potential revenge by the incoming Trump administration, by the incoming President Trump. President Biden just announcing, as you note, that he is pardoning Dr. Anthony Fauci, retired General Mark Milley, and members of the House Committee that investigated the January 6th attack on the Capitol. That includes Liz Cheney, Adam Schiff, Adam Kinzinger, among others, as well as Capitol and D.C. police who testified before that committee. I want to share with you part of what the president writes. He says, in part, our nation relies on dedicated, selfless public servants every day. They are the lifeblood of our democracy. Yet alarmingly, he adds, public servants have been subjected to ongoing threats and intimidation for faithfully discharging their duties. Notably, his last comments in this statement add that these pardons, he says, should not be mistaken as an acknowledgement that any individual engaged in any wrongdoing, he says, nor should acceptance by them be misconstrued as any admission of guilt for any offense. He says our nation, quote, owes these public servants a debt of gratitude for their tireless commitment to our country. Now, let's back up for a moment. President Trump, incoming President Trump, as you know, has been a fierce critic and has really railed against so many of those individuals that are receiving these pardons today. Most recently, in late December of last year, Donald Trump verbally attacked Liz Cheney, saying that she committed, quote, egregious and unthinkable acts of crime. That was December 22nd, less than a month ago, of Mark Milley. In the past, he suggested that he deserved execution, in effect, that some of the actions he had taken in the past would have been worthy of execution. So to be clear, Joe Biden, some of his final actions now to preemptively pardon some of those high-profile figures. Savannah.
All right, we want to turn now to Kristen Welker, moderator of Meet the Press, and Hallie Jackson, NBC's senior Washington correspondent. Peter really raises the point that needs to be made here. There were sometimes explicit, sometimes implicit threats, serious threats against Liz Cheney, Mark Milley, and others by Trump or by members of his team. So this pardon potentially has real life consequences for these individuals.
It absolutely does. When I interviewed President-elect Trump in December, he was quite clear. He said, I think members of the January 6th committee should go to jail. He did not mince words. I said, you think Liz Cheney should go to jail? He said, yes. Never said what the crime was, by the way, and since then has not laid out the crime. What's notable is that you have committee members like Liz Cheney, like Senator Adam Schiff saying, we didn't do anything wrong. We don't want a pardon. But here's the key thing to know. Once the president issues these pardons, that's it. You don't get to reject it. The pardon is there. And so this is a significant historic moment because it speaks to the concerns about the threats of legal repercussions that the January 6th committee and all of the other folks, General Mark Milley, yeah, might be facing. Remember that tweet? You said not sometimes threats very clear against Mark Milley saying that he should, in effect, be executed for treason. happened. So this is a significant moment because I think it does underscore the very real concerns about what might happen.
And again, Hallie, all of this unfolding in just the last 10 minutes, I know we don't probably have a great deal of reaction from some of these folks who've been pardoned yet, but are we hearing anything at all from...
A little bit. I can tell you that I just spoke with somebody connected to the events of January 6th who is subject to receiving this pardon, who said that it was one of the lines that President Biden talked about, that these individuals did nothing wrong, that really resonated with this person who only found out about this sort of through the grapevine, has not officially heard from the White House yet, just in the overnight hours here. So to your point, Craig, this is all moving quickly. It is not altogether unexpected. Kristen talks about this being a significant legal point and significant legal milestone. It is also significant politically. Remember that one of the things that Democrats campaigned on for months was this idea that President-elect Trump, who was then a candidate, could enact political revenge on people he considered quote-unquote enemies. Remember that his incoming FBI director, if in fact Kash Patel is confirmed, wrote a book and in it put an appendix of dozens of people who he described as members of the deep state, which also raised that concern. Kristen, you're reporting this morning on confirming that there will be more than 50 people who may have their national security clearances revoked because of concerns raised about their involvement in sort of tossing down the Hunter Biden laptop story. So there's a lot here that I think Democrats are concerned about. It's not an unexpected move, but it is a big deal by President Biden.
On a day like this, that rare day when we have two presidents one day, we have President Biden issuing pardons on the way out. President-elect Trump saying he may issue some pardons on the way in. You hear about executive orders. Just to be clear, this pardon power that the Constitution provides a president is sweeping, it is complete, and it cannot be undone by the next president. So if you're wondering, could President Trump unpardon those pardons today?
No.
No. The answer is no.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier is coming home after nearly half a century behind bars. Just minutes before leaving office, former President Biden granted Peltier clemency, ordering his release from prison to serve the remainder of his life sentence in home confinement. In a statement shared by the NDN Collective, Leonard Peltier responded by saying, quote, "It's finally over. I'm going home. I want to show the world I'm a good person with a good heart. I want to help the people just like my grandmother taught me," Leonard said. Biden's historic decision came after mounting calls by tribal leaders and supporters in a community-led campaign that fought for Peltier's freedom for decades. Biden's order goes into effect February 18th. Biden, however, reiterated his action was not a pardon for Peltier. Leonard Peltier is 80 years old, has spent the majority of his life in prison. For decades, he's maintained his innocence over the 1975 killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Many have said his conviction was riddled with irregularities and prosecutorial misconduct, and that the federal government failed to prove its case against Leonard Peltier. Democratic presidents Bill Clinton, Barack Obama rejected Peltier's clemency requests. He was also denied parole in 93, 2009 and 2024. For more, we go to Sumterville, Florida, where we're joined by Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of the NDN Collective. He just visited Leonard Peltier in prison after news of his release yesterday. Nick, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you share with us Leonard Peltier's response? It was minutes before Biden left office.
Leonard is elated. Leonard is excited. He's deeply, deeply honored. When he, like, I talked to him on the phone last night after the actual order was given to him, and the papers for executive clemency were given to him, and he read it out loud, and he said, I'm finally coming home. And he's excited to be coming home in this moment. And one of the biggest things of the message that he has is deep gratitude for the five decades of organizing and everybody who's ever helped fight for his freedom. And so he is elated. He's excited to go back to his homelands in Belcourt, North Dakota, on the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa.
And Nick, could you talk about the movement to get Leonard Peltier released? There was a large group of congressmen led by Raul Grijalva who appealed to the president. But at the same time, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, on January 10th, wrote to the president urging him not to do it.
Yeah, this was an unprecedented effort of both community organizing and advocacy. You know, we had two secretaries of the administration weigh in. Secretary Deb Haaland was weighing in, and Secretary HHS Administrator Becerra was weighing in. Senator Schatz, the Senate chairman of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, was weighing in. And there was opposition. There was opposition led by the FBI and the Department of Justice to try to keep Leonard Peltier in prison. But the reality is that we had fought so hard to be able to bring this issue to light. And I think that one of the tipping points in this entire issue was the fact that Leonard Peltier was a boarding school survivor, and that this was really about righting a historical wrong. And I think all of the work that went into bringing to light what the United States government did to Indian people during the boarding schools, and all of that effort and organizing and healing work that happened, was one of the huge contributing factors, along with so much political advocacy of people championing this. And we were able to close the gap from the front line in indigenous communities to the decision makers, right to the president of the United States, that led to this. And so it was a historical organizing effort and a day of victory for indigenous people.
Absolutely amazing, Nick. We talked to you right after you talked to the pardon office. You were in South Dakota then, after you went to Washington, D.C. Finally, on the issue of Leonard Peltier going home, how is his health?
He needs to see a doctor right away. We were a little bit concerned that he's not going home until the 18th, that the order doesn't go into effect till the 18th. He needs to see a doctor immediately, and they don't have the medical facilities at Coleman Prison, federal prison, to meet his medical needs right now. So we will be asking this current the incoming administration for relief for medical purposes to try to get him home a little bit sooner. And they do have the ability to do that at the Bureau of Prisons level. And so we're going to be asking for that so we can get him to see a doctor. But realistically, we also understand that there's a good chance that he's probably not coming home till the 18th, even though we're trying to get him home sooner. But we really want to get him home sooner because his health is continuing to deteriorate. And he's excited to come home, but we got to make his health and his safety number one priority.
Nick Tilson, you've also worked on climate issues for years. On Monday, Trump signed an executive order to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement again.
The next item here is the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty. We're going to save over $1 trillion by withdrawing from that treaty.
So you hear him signing this in the Capital One arena with 20,000 people cheering. The significance of this, Nick.
It's terrible. It's terrible for everybody around the world, because not only the Paris Climate Agreements, but the agreements to for the most powerful countries in the world to come together to fight climate change and set bars for it, to force corporations and force countries to be able to, have regulations in place. And to pull these back is to put our environment at risk, and to put human rights at risk, and to put and these decisions are going to expedite climate change. And at a time when climate change is a global crisis issue affecting all of humanity, and with indigenous people, it means a direct threat to us and our homelands, because we are maintaining, we're 5% of the world's population, but steward 80% of the world's biological diversity on behalf of all of humanity. And so that means when him pulling out of the Paris Accords, it means that he's going to make indigenous communities and indigenous homelands sacrifice zones. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be on the front lines having to fight these corporations, because now they're and going to end up into our territories completely deregulated.
Nick, there's so much to talk to you about, but I want to quickly, it's a fire hose of executive orders. President Trump also signed an executive order Monday calling for North America's tallest peak, Denali, in Alaska, to be renamed Mount McKinley after President McKinley. He said, showing respect to Ohio and to the president. Can you talk about the significance of what Obama renamed in 2015?
Well, renaming these, we have been in this effort to rename our territories after what we call them as indigenous people. And this effort to try to erase indigenous people and erase our identities, that's what this is. It is manifest destiny in its modern form. It is colonial rule that is trying to control the narrative and is trying to erase indigenous people. And so we're going to continue to fight to hold on to our names. We're going to continue to fight to hold on to our identity. And we're going to use this energy that we have in Indian country right now that we have gotten from this victory in fighting for Leonard Peltier to protect our homelands and to protect the names and to make sure that they won't erase us. And you can guarantee the indigenous people that we're going to be on the front lines fighting this administration and making a way for our people and fighting for human rights everywhere.
Well, Nick, we want to thank you for being with us. Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of the NDN Collective. You can go to Democracy Now! To see all our coverage of Leonard Peltier, including interviews with him. Again, at the age of 80, Leonard Peltier is going home after almost half a century in prison.
This video is for the government. I think the real national security threat is having an undereducated population. I tutor for the SAT, and I don't know if you guys know this, I'm sure you do. There's a literacy crisis in this country, but you may not know is that there's also a math crisis in this country. I have 18-year-olds who don't know what 4 divided by 4 is. They're going to college. Negative, 6 minus 4. Oh no, right? They don't know how to define percentages. Don't ask them, how much are you supposed to tip? What's a 4% tip? They don't know these things. I think the reason why they implemented Desmos into the SAT is to make it easier. Desmos is a calculator, if you guys don't know. I have kids who tell me that they have a math teacher in their class, and inside of their classroom, the math teacher is teaching to 2 different math classes. 2 different levels of math they're teaching because they don't have enough math teachers. There's 2 classes in one. I have kids who tell me that they have a long-term sub in their classroom who has no math background. I've got kids who said, yeah, last year we had a long-term sub. They quit in the middle of the year. Then we had no teacher, and now we got pushed on to the next grade, and we don't know what the fuck is going on. I've got kids in charter school, and they show me what they're doing. They show me their curriculum, and that's fucking fraud. What they're doing, their school is committing fraud, because that's not an education. Do you understand? So I think maybe that's the national security threat. Okay? Not a fucking social media app, which, by the way, it's an app that I post free math tutorials on. That's what I'm doing. Well, what are you guys doing?
Okay. 2 things can be true. China could want to own America and Americans and everything in it. And somebody pointed out, you know, all of the memes of Trump and how much fun we're making of him, FOTUS, you could never do that to Xi Jinping and live to talk about it. You cannot pay your taxes. If you owe China $1 and you're Jackie Chan, or who's the guy that owned, what was the name of their damn Alibaba? Jack Ma, he got disappeared. There was a famous actress, Smith, you remember this? Anyway, I remember this because I was teaching at the time and students were like, oh my God, she had like 50 million followers.
Right.
She didn't pay all her money because you're supposed to split the money with the Chinese government. They hemmed her up. She was missing for like 6 weeks. Okay, Smith, hold on. I know it's something like Bing Bong Bing. Oh, Fan Bing Bong. Fan Bing Bing.
Okay.
Fan Bing Bing. And you still don't know who she is, right?
They
messed her up for 6 weeks. When she resurfaced, she apologized.
Oh, I do remember this story. Yes. Oh,
I'm sorry. I said, what did they do to her?
Yeah. One of the craziest stories? One of the craziest stories during COVID was how they could be like, COVID outbreak, everybody stay where you at. Like if you in New York and you like on your way home from work, you're not on your way home from work no more. That's it. And I was like, they different over there. And then on the day that they decided, F it, we not doing COVID no more, they literally just said, that's it. Like, it wasn't no slow, but it was like, y'all on your own, then fine. Y'all ain't want to do, y'all don't like being locked down. Everybody, free.
They were welding people into their homes. What are you talking about, Rod? You couldn't leave your house because they were welding you into your house.
Yes.
Like, people want to play this game. Two things could be true. China's horrible. So is America.
Yes.
And if I'm going to pick horrors, I'm going to pick the horror that's not going to have me disappear with no, way of having any kind of rights or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Shoot.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Wow. Oh, yeah. Well, it remains to be seen. You're right. We might be entering into one of those periods.
I don't know. I don't fucking know. How y'all let this happen? America.
Come on.
I hate to sound like Bernie Mac, but America, what are we doing, dog?
What are we doing? The only thing is I'm now a staunch states' rights advocate.
Yeah.
States' rights. Jersey, we need to secede from the union.
Right. I'm in a purple state, so I'm scared. I don't know which way it's gonna flow with these fools. I'm telling you this much.
Go towards Raleigh and shine.
The thing I'm trying to do is just make sure that I'm on the list below a bunch of other people, because I got people I'm watching, because I'm like, they're gonna get you first.
Correct.
Like, I be talking my trash, but I feel like it's some people, you know, I feel like they getting they probably gonna get LeBron and them out of here first.
You think
like
so?
They definitely because the NBA dudes is openly like, we don't mess with Trump.
White people love them some.
I know.
It's a conundrum.
Right.
They are rooting for these athletes.
I know.
But they can't stand the people.
But I'm just saying, if we cross the threshold to we disappearing people, it's some high profile people they're going to use to send a signal to tell the rest of us to shut the hell up. Like, you don't disappearing me ain't gonna teach enough people a lesson. But you disappear somebody they care about, everybody, even I'm gonna be at home like, oh, we can't. So do I need to type his name with an asterisk in it? They're like, what are we doing with this? I'm like, you gotta scare me. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think we gotta watch. We need to be very aware, because it might not even be disappeared in the obvious. It may just be like, oh, LeBron went on a vacation like he did this year.
Correct.
But if he came back and was like, you know what, actually, man, I think we need to get Trump a chance, I would have been like, oh, that's the first one.
Clone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a clone.
If Jamie Foxx would have did that special and said, why can't we all just be together? Like, I was like, oh, see, you was the first one.
I'm looking at Don Lemon. I'm saying,
yeah, Don.
If he goes away, that's
yeah, Don a good one.
I feel like Roland might be above me on the list, maybe.
Roland, you and Roland is y'all next.
Hold up.
If Smears don't email me 1 week, I'm going to know. Smears like, we don't need you this Friday. I'm going to be like, oh, damn, they done got Karen.
Oh, shoot. Now, Stephen A is good, Smears. You ain't got he ain't got to worry.
Nah, Stephen A will be fine.
He is absolutely good. He has figured this out. He's playing the game very well.
Yeah.
Damn it. Now you got me thinking, who, if they get snatched up, will I be like, oh,
Who was that?
Civil rights leader. We ain't got to worry about them either. Oh, my God.
It's going to be some of the celebrities that was stomping for Kamala.
Joy Ann Reed.
Oh, Joy definitely on the list.
She's definitely above it.
She on the list. Yeah, you see Joy, something happened to Joy, you need to go ahead and start getting the go bag together.
Africa.
Go over there with them 30 white people and see what they got some space left.
Citizenship. Look,
right.
Look, my DNA. Okay. Why we laughing to keep from crying? Okay.
That's what we got to do.
Smith said Whoopi Goldberg. No, Whoopi waxes and wanes.
Whoopi will be all right. She said it was okay for them to perform at the inauguration. So
they already got to her.
Be all right.
She's a clone. They already.
She might be right. you know what? I'm gonna start watching The View in the morning. I gotta see some things about Whoopi, see what her stances are now.
Sunny might be on the list ahead of me.
Sunny on the list for sure. Yeah. She go way too hard. Oh, low key, we need to be looking at some of these Republicans.
Like who?
Because like the Latino woman that be on The View, she definitely on the list.
Oh, Anna
Liz Cheney, her ass on the list. Liz Cheney ass on that list.
Okay.
So, I'm going to be watching some, because they might be the first ones. They might get to us second. I think they're going to be going for some day.
You know what? Here's the other thing. We ain't no threat.
Right. Don't nobody be listening to us.
Don't listen to black people.
Please.
Oh, my goodness.
This is jokes.
TJ in El Paso. Pass the old El Paso. Welcome.
First of all, Ken, you know, hey, Ken. Hello,
hey.
Ken. Hi.
Hey, TJ.
Hey, but check this out. I was calling about something funny, but y'all got serious about people disappearing. So how
about
that?
That was jokes. No, that's all jokes.
Listen, I got a name then. Jasmine Crockett.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. She'll definitely be front line, front and center.
If Jasmine Crockett get up there and start talking about, we should just all get along. Hey,
I'm leaving the country.
Paso, just so y'all know.
You're in danger,
listen,
though.
Y'all ain't got to. Listen, stop talking about y'all leaving. Let me explain something to you guys. In El Paso, we have a protective barrier. An hour east, north, or west, there's a checkpoint. This is the Democratic stronghold. And then you go south to Mexico where the Seminoles did. I'm trying to tell you, you ain't got to leave the country. Just come to El Paso.
All right, how much
come to El Paso.
TJ, hold on, TJ. Hold on, let me ask you this, because this is important. So El Chapo had tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
El Chapo had tunnels.
I saw the tunnels with my own two eyes.
He tunneled out of jail. What are you talking about? They tunneled his ass out of jail.
El Chapo is in Sinaloa. Sinaloa to El Paso is like El Paso to New York City.
Oh, okay. It's a long way. Okay. So we can't get to the tunnels. Okay. Okay. I'm asking you to build a tunnel. TJ, get busy.
Thank you for listening today.
How often have major media outlets questioned Secretary of State Antony Blinken or President Biden and said, how would you feel if your son or daughter was blown up courtesy of U.S. taxpayers? Why don't you insist that Israel stop bombing or all of the weapons will be cut off? These are basic, logical questions, but when they are avoided, then we're getting this sort of parody of journalism, which is more stenography than anything else.
That's Norman Solomon, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Norman Solomon on war and the media. In times of war, the corporate media play a salient role in shaping public opinion. There are worthy and unworthy victims. They neatly divide certain categories. Muslims, Arabs, and Iranians generally fall into that latter category, whereas Washington and its allies are worthy victims who deserve our support and empathy. The current phase of the Gaza war did not begin on October 7th, as the media repeat ad nauseum. But to dig into the underlying causes and provide context and history rarely occurs because it would undermine the dominant propaganda. Thus, the Nora O'Donnells, Wolf Blitzers, Lester Holtz, and other corporate news anchors don't question the embedded assumptions and simply mimic, with few exceptions, the dominant official line. Our guest today is Norman Solomon. He's a political commentator and media critic. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-founder of RootsAction.org, an online activist group. He's the author of many books. His latest is War Made Invisible. I talked with him on October 11th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, you wrote War Made Invisible before the Israeli attack on Gaza in response to the events of October 7th. And then you've crucially have added an afterword. Talk about the ingredients of that and how things have evolved.
I thought a lot when I was working on the afterword about the Gaza war. I tried to grasp how the events after October 7th, 2023, have related to the basic themes of the initial book. After all, the title War Made Invisible might at first, you know, seem counterintuitive because the Gaza war got tremendous and has gotten to some degree still a significant amount of U.S. media coverage. But it became really clear that the quantity of coverage didn't mean that the war itself has been visible. After all, the realities of war are death, maiming, terror, and very little of that has come through the news media coverage of the Gaza war, I think for two basic reasons. One is the inherent limitations of journalism to convey what it's really like to have missiles and bombs coming at you and the carnage and the death and the suffering, the loss, the mourning, the grief. Very difficult for TV, radio, newspapers, scrolling on a screen to convey to us what that's